Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Pranamane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Vacharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya De Satarane Om Agyana Timanandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Swapadankitam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Uta Parakamalam Shri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tham Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Prajna Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shiva Sakan Vitam Scha He Krishna Karna Sindo Dinabando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Taptakanshana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshri Vrishubhanu Sudadevi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanshakapa Dhruvyascha Kripa Sindhubhye Vacha Pajitana Bhavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Pranitananda Chedvaita Gadadhar Shivasudhi Gaur Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Bhagavate Vasudevaya Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 10 Chapter 79 Lord Balaram goes on pilgrimage. Text number 16. That was written. 17 though. Tatra Ayutam Adat Denu Brahmanebhya Hala Ayuda Kritamalam Tam Ram Parnim Malayam Cha Kula Achalam Tatra yutam adadenor Brahmanevyo halayuda Kritamalayam tamraparnim Malayam chakulachalam Tatra yutam adadhenur Brahmanevyo halayuda Kritamalam tamraparnim Malayam chakulachalam Tatra, there. At Setu Bandhu, also known as Rameshwaram, Ayutam, 10,000. Adat, he gave away. Denu, cows. Brahmanevya, to the Brahmanas. Hala Ayuda Lord Balaram, whose weapon is the plow. Kritamalam to the Kritamala River. Tamraparanim, the Tamraparani River. Malayam, Malaya. Cha, also. Kula Achalam, the principal mountain range. Translation and there's no purports. There at Setu Bandhu, Rameshwaram, Lord Halayuda gave Brahmanas 10,000 cows in charity. He then visited the Kritamala and the Tamraparani rivers and the great Malayan mountains. Everyone remember that? Is that written on there? No. Hard to remember all this. In the Malayan range, Lord Balaram found Agastya Rishi sitting in meditation. After bowing down to the sage, the Lord offered him prayers and then received blessings from him. Taking leave from Agastya, he proceeded to the shore of the southern ocean where he saw Goddess Durga in her form of Kanya Kumari. So, where did Lord Balaram go? The southern ocean, well, I guess it's. And then what else? Where was the different places on the southern ocean? Well, I guess you can just look there. There are different rivers like the Setu Bandha. Here is Rameshwara. And Kritamala, Taparani, Malayan Mountains. And who did he meet at in the Malayan Mountains? Who? Augustus. Yes. And what happened when he met Augustus? What else? Yes. And what was the name of the form of Durga he saw in the southern ocean? Yes. So text 18. Next he went to Palguna Tirtha and bathed in the sacred Panchapsara lake, where Lord Vishnu had directly manifested himself. At this place, he gave away another 10,000 cows. The Supreme Lord then traveled through the kingdom of Kerala and Trigartha, visiting Lord Shiva's sacred city of Gokarna, where Lord Durjati Shiva directly manifests himself. After also visiting Goddess Parvati, who dwells on an island, Lord Balaram went to the holy district of Sorparaka and bathed in the Tapi, Poshni, and the Miravinda rivers. He next entered the Dandaka forest and went to the river Reva, along which the city of Mahishmati is found. Then he bathed at Manu Tirtha and finally returned to Prabhasa. The Lord heard from some Brahmanas how all the kings involved in the battle between the Kurus and the Pandavas had been killed. From this he concluded that the earth was now relieved of her burden. Wanting to stop the club fight, then raging between Bhima and Duryodhana, on the battlefield Lord Balaram went to Kurukshetra. Mind you, this took a year. It took us 5 minutes to read it, but it took Lord Balaram a year to go to all these places. When Yudhisthira, Lord Krishna, Arjuna, the twin brothers, Nakula and Sahadev, saw Lord Balaram, they offered him respectful obeisances, but said nothing, thinking, what does he come here to tell us? Purport. Srila Prabhupada writes, the reason why they were silent was that Lord Balaram was somewhat affectionate toward Duryodhana, and Duryodhana had learned from Balaramji the art of fighting with a club. Thus, when the fighting was going on, King Yudhisthira and others thought that Balaram might have come there to say something in favor of Duryodhana, and therefore they remained silent. Lord Balaram found Duryodhana and Bhima with clubs in their hands, each furiously striving for victory over the other, as they circled about skillfully. The Lord addressed them as follows. Lord Balaram said, King Duryodhana and Bhima, listen.
You two warriors are equal in fighting prowess. I know that one of you has greater physical power, while the other is better trained in technique. Purport, Bhima was physically more powerful, but Duryodhana was more advanced in terms of technique. Since, actually, Duryodhana had granted by his mother some invincibility, because his mother had taken a vow when she was married to Dhritarashtra, she covered her eyes. And because of that austerity of following her blind husband by covering her own eyes, therefore she became very powerful by her austerity. And right before the battle of Kurukshetra, she wanted to bestow invincibility upon her son, Duryodhana. So he asked Duryodhana to come before her naked, and she was going to uncover her eyes, and by the power of her eyes, she was going to bestow upon him that his body would become invincible. But Duryodhana was about to go to his mother when Krishna saw him naked and said, "What's going on?" "I knew you were embarrassed. Shouldn't you at least cover your loins? Put on a loincloth at least. How can you walk around naked like that?" So he convinced Duryodhana to put on a cloth, and then his mother opened her, took off the cloth, saw Duryodhana, and all the parts of his body except for his loins became invincible. And then she realized that Krishna had tricked my son. And just remember that simultaneously before, Bhima had made a vow that he was going to, when they were trying to strip Draupadi, and then Duryodhana showed Draupadi his thigh and said, "Why don't you sit here?" So Bhima became very angry and said, "I'm going to break that thigh of Duryodhana." So that was what was covered by the cloth. And here they're fighting and they're evenly matched, and Krishna, as usual, gives Duryodhana the hint, or Bhima the hint, how to kill Duryodhana. Krishna knew all along and made all the arrangements. "Since you are so evenly matched in fighting prowess, I do not see how either of you can win or lose this duel. Therefore, please stop this useless battle." Shukadeva Goswami continued, "They did not accept Lord Balaram's request, O King, although it was logical, for their mutual enmity was irrevocable. Each of them constantly remembered the insults and injuries he had suffered from the other." So it wasn't just that Duryodhana had insulted the Pandavas. When they were younger, Bhima used to insult Duryodhana. Like, for instance, there were 100 brothers of Duryodhana, and sometimes they climb into a tree, and Bhima very playfully would shake the tree and knock them all out of the tree. That way they'd fall on the ground and break their arms and their legs. So somehow or another, Bhima wasn't their favorite cousin. So Duryodhana was always thinking about how I can get even with Bhima, even to the point that he wanted to kill Bhima. Constantly made plans to kill him one time, because Bhima was voracious in his eating. It was very easy to get him to eat anything. Didn't matter what it was, he ate it. So one time they called him together for his birthday, and they gave him a cake. But the cake was made out of 100% poison. So Bhima ate the cake and he felt a little tired. He said, "Oh, I think maybe I should sit down to rest." And he said, "Oh, that's normal after eating," they told him. "Just sit down and rest and we'll take care of you, don't worry." So he lay down to sleep and they picked him up and they threw him into a lake. In the lake they put all kinds of venomous snakes. And as soon as Bhima was thrown into the lake, all the venomous snakes started to bite his body. But the poison from the snakes counteracted the poison from the cake, and he woke up. And he was just about to come back to the surface when the servants of Varuna came and took him to Varuna Loka. And there Varuna greeted him very nicely, gave him different elixirs, and each one of them made him more stronger than 10,000 elephants. So though Duryodhana was thinking that now we finished Bhima, oh how unfortunate. Poor Bhima. We don't know where he is, we don't know what happened to him. But But actually, by their trickery, it was arranged that he became more powerful than 10,000 elephants. So it all worked to their advantage. So now they're fighting, they're remembering all these different things. They were constantly in enmity towards each other. They're always trying to kill each other in one way or another. Concluding that the battle was the arrangement of fate, Lord Balaram went back to Dwarka. There he was greeted by Ugrasena and his other relatives, were all delighted to see him. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti explains that the word dishtam, fate, indicates that the battle between Bhima and Duryodhana had been enjoined by Lord Krishna and set into motion by him. Krishna wanted someone to kill Duryodhana, and he had arranged that Bhima was going to kill him. Later, Lord Balaram returned to Naimisharanya, where the sages joyfully engaged him. He invited him to all sacrifice in performing various kinds of Vedic sacrifice. Lord Balaram was now retired from warfare. Purport. Lord Srila Prabhupada writes, when Lord Balaram went to the holy place of pilgrimage at Naimisharanya, the sages, saintly persons, and Brahmins all received him standing. They understood that Lord Balaram, although a Kshatriya, was now retired from the fighting business. The Brahmins and the sages, who were always striving for peace and tranquility, were very pleased at this. All of them embraced Balaram with great affection and induced him to perform various kinds of sacrifices in that sacred spot of Naimisharanya. Actually, Lord Balaram had no business performing the sacrifices recommended to ordinary human beings. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore he himself is the enjoyer of all such sacrifices. As such, his exemplary action performing sacrifices was only to give a lesson to your common man to show how one should abide by the injunctions of the Vedas. The Bhagavad Gita Krishna says, Jagna dana sapa karma na tyajam karyam eva tat Jagno dana sapaschaiva pavanani manishina. That sacrifice, charity, and penance should never be given up, they must be performed. Indeed, sacrifice, charity, and penance are purifying even for the great souls. So the idea of sacrifice, charity, and penance, as Krishna explains, that in this age, in Krita Yuga, Sati Yuga, Krite Tadhyayato Vishnum, Tretayam yajito mukai, dwarpayam paricharyam kalotadhari kirtana. That in Krita Yuga or Sati Yuga, people could meditate directly in trance upon Krishna. And in Treta Yuga, people perform sacrifice. So what was the idea of sacrifice? The idea of sacrifice is because we're attached to the material energy, thinking ourselves to be the proprietors and the enjoyers of the material energy. Therefore, one has to utilize the material energy in sacrifice. So what will be the result of sacrifice? The result of sacrifice is that our consciousness should become free from our attachments, and therefore we should be able to meditate in trance upon Krishna. So the idea of all the activities of the Vedas is ultimately to arrive at the stage of meditating on trance upon Krishna. As Krishna says, Yesham antikatam papam jananam punya karmanam te dvandva mohin niramukva vajante mam dhrida vrataha. So this is dhrida vrata. Fix. So worshipping Krishna fixed means to be constantly absorbed in meditating on him. The whole aim of sadhana bhakti, which we're performing, is always to remember Krishna and never forget him. Smartavyam, Sadatam Vishnor Vismartav Chatu Nakinchit, Sarva Vidhi Nisedyasyor Etiura Eva Kinkara. That all the rules and regulations ultimately wind up in helping us become conscious of Krishna, remembering him, and never forgetting him. Now, before we can do that, Krishna says, Yesham antakatam papam. Antakatam, being finished with all papam, sinful activities. So this is not so easy. Getting free from sinful activities doesn't mean that we just refrain from the four gross sinful activities, illicit sex, meeting, intoxication, gambling, for a few weeks or months or a year or whatever. Or as we say, sometimes the devotees, they would think it would be much more, it would be much nicer if there were only three regular principles. No meat, no fish, no eggs. Sometimes they may think like that. So, antikatam pāpam, getting free from all sinful activities, means even the tendency or the proclivity towards sinful activity. Because sinful activity manifests itself principally as avidya. Avidya is the root cause of sin. Avidya means ignorance. As long as we're not fully situated in Krishna consciousness, then there must be some avidya. If we don't know who we are, and then we must be in ignorance. If we don't actually know our spiritual identity, then we must be to some degree in ignorance. But ignorance is not the only manifestation of our bewilderment. It's bad enough to be in ignorance, but then we have asmita. We're not only, we don't know who we are, but we're so crazy we think ourselves to be something that we're really not. It's bad enough not to know who we actually are, but then to identify yourself with someone that you're not is even worse. That's called asmita, false ego. And it's bad enough to identify ourselves as something that we're not, but then to become completely absorbed in fulfilling the desires, the conditioned desires, the attachments and aversions that accompany the body that we got, that even absorbs us more in the material entity. And then, after fulfilling all, trying to fulfill these desires and becoming averse to so many things that we think are obstacles to our desires, then the next thing is abhinivesita. That is, we're always fearful being absorbed in the bodily concept of life. We're always afraid of being annihilated. So, miserable condition. So these are also considered the five kleshas that Lord Brahma created when he manifested the universe. Maha Maya, etc. Or anger after frustration, the bodily concept of life, there's other ways of explaining it too. The bodily concept of life, anger after frustration, fear of death, material attachment, etc. Therefore, antikatam means that we have to get free from the false ego, and along with that can be explained a different way, papam, the tendency towards sin. That includes rag and avesha, dvesha, rag and dvesha. This attachment and aversion. We're attached to things so we want to get them, we want to enjoy them, and we're averse to things that we think are going to put us in a position where there'll be obstacles for our happiness. This is called love and hate. Actually, we love to devour things in this material world. We want to possess things so we can devour them. And we hate the things that are preventing us from controlling and conquering the universe. Every conditioned soul wants to conquer the whole universe. But we take it a little at a time. One carrot at a time we eat. Thinking, now I become the master of the carrot. Tomorrow will be a cauliflower and a potato. And if one becomes very powerful, gets a lot of money, then he wants more and more wives, more and more houses, bigger and bigger kingdom, the whole earth, the whole universe, a couple of universes. There's even a religion that tells you you can do it. Multi-marketed religion. That you become the controller of one universe if you become qualified. And in that universe, you're there with your whole family, all your wives and your children and the grandfather and grandmother and all the pets are there also, the pet parakeet and dog and cat, they're all there, and you're the Lord. Lord Jesus Christ trains you up, you become the Lord of the universe, and then when you become really good, you become the Lord of two universes. You expand gradually, and then you get five universes, and it goes on multi-level marketing. You become more and more of a controller. That's perfection. Little do people realize that if, as long as you're trying to, one is trying to control the universe, there is so much anxiety and problems. Just like trying to control this little part of the universe that we're in, so many people get a headache. And what to speak if you become a Brahma trying to control the big universe, then you get four headaches. The Brahma has four heads, he gets four headaches. And what to speak if you become a bigger universe with some Brahmas have 10 heads, some have 100, some have 100,000, 10 million. Imagine having 10 million headaches. How many aspirins would you have to take? Spend hundreds of years just trying to find your mouth and taking the aspirin. So this idea of papam, attachment, aversion, and then this, or actually the first is bijam, the tendency towards sin, and then there's papam, the actual sinful activity. So people are thinking, I'm going to enjoy, but actually they're simply suffering. The only enjoyment is that when the senses meet their objects, then temporarily there's a cessation of the anxiety for the senses to meet their objects. And therefore, we feel a relief from the anxiety. And that we call that peace or enjoyment or happiness. And as soon as the senses devour their objects, then at once the fire of material desire blazes again. And one wants another object to devour. That's called greed. And as soon as one can no longer serve one's greed, to satisfy one's greed, then frustration, anger arises. So trying to fulfill lust ultimately winds up in greed and anger. No one wants to become frustrated and angry, but it's inevitable. By trying to gratify the senses, everyone winds up ultimately dissatisfied. Therefore, Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita, Sattvam sanjayate jnanam rajaso lova evacha pramado moha tamaso bhavato jnana evacha. That by knowledge, or by acting the mode of goodness, one gets knowledge. Because purification, when the senses become purified, of the desire to lord it over the material energy and to enjoy it, then one can see things more clearly. We already have perfect senses as spiritual souls. They're just covered over by imperfect material senses. So when the imperfect material senses are purified, then one automatically sees things more clearly. And the most important thing is we see that we're actually not the body. And we see that there's actually a supreme controller who's controlling all bodies, including our body. That we're not acting independently. Nothing's going on independently of him. So that's called knowledge. Not simply some technical knowledge of how to build a faster car or a faster computer. Real knowledge is to understand who we actually are and how things are factually, under whose direction things are working in the material world. Then, in the mode of passion, greed develops. And in the mode of ignorance, madness, illusion, and pramado, moha, tamaso, bhavato, jnana, evacha, and the loss of all real knowledge. And then, sattvam, sukhe, sanjayate, sattvam, karmasu, karmanad, karmanad, sukritasyahu, satyakam, nirmalam, palam, From real knowledge comes purification. because one knows things as they are, then he acts for purification rather than become bewildered by material illusion. And in the mode of passion, one becomes unhappy eventually, because one cannot fulfill one's desires and one finds oneself frustrated. And the result of all this madness and illusion and loss of intelligence is that one completely becomes stock-raving mad. Therefore, practically the whole society, or even Prabhupada when he's telling the case of the person who was in a courtroom. Prabhupada was in the courtroom because he had a court case himself. His servant had sold some drugs to an unlicensed doctor in India. In India, generally, many of the doctors are unlicensed, but you're not allowed to sell prescription drugs to them. So Prabhupada was in court about his license to sell prescription drugs. So he was sitting there in court, and one doctor, he was being tried for murdering his servant. His servant was having an affair with his wife, that is the doctor's wife, and the doctor invited the servant to come into his operation room and then chloroformed him, knocked him unconscious, and cut his body into little pieces. Put him into a box and was carrying the box out, but blood was dripping from the box. So one policeman was passing by, saw all the blood dripping from the box, opened the box and saw a barbecue inside. Put the pieces together and found out it was the doctor's servant. The doctor was arrested, he was being tried for murder, and his plea was not guilty by reason of insanity. Prabhupada said they called the expert psychiatrist. He came and gave his testimony and said, yes, as far as I can see, this man is crazy. But then again, everyone I've examined so far in my life has also been crazy. So if you want to excuse him because he's crazy, that's all right, because everyone's crazy. He said he must be crazy too. The final verdict is they decide to hang the man. And his lawyer said, "Don't." This is the high court, the Supreme Court in India. And the lawyer said, "Don't worry, I'll get you off by appeal." It was the final court, there is no appeal. He said, "No worries, mine, we'll get you off by appeal." He, of course, he hung, but he was hung. So everyone is crazy in the material world. And the result of all the madness that people go through, they simply become completely crazy. On the other hand, sacrifice, or again we were on to Papa, and then from this sinful activity comes two different types of reaction. One is called Parabdha and Aparabdha karma. That is, Parabdha means the immediately manifestation of the result of the sinful activity. Prabhupada gives the example, if one has illicit sex, then he might get venereal disease. So that's the Parabdha karma of illicit sex. But then there is also Aparabdha karma stored up as reaction in the future. There is also an effect of the sinful activity which is stored and will be manifested later, usually as kutam, the tendency towards sinful activity. So one may be cured of the venereal disease, but because there's a tendency to commit illicit sex, later on, one will fall victim to illicit sex again, and therefore, because of that kutam or tendency, there'll be the desire for the same activity again, which will lead to sinful activity, and again, one will fall victim to the same problem again. So unless one alleviates the sinful tendency, the sinful desire from the heart, unless one becomes free from ignorance, then there's no relief from sinful reaction. And the only actual relief, or the only relief from avidya or ignorance, is to find out who we really are, to realize it. So that's the only method of an antakaha, yesham antakatam paapam. To actually get completely free from all sinful reaction means that one has to become fully Krishna conscious. And yesham antakatam paapam, jananam punya karmanam. To actually, pious activities means to perform activities which will bring us to the platform of pure devotion to Krishna. without devotion to Krishna, all activities will gradually degrade us into the bodily concept of lust. And then, yesham antikatam papam, jaranam punyakarma, te dvandva. As we become elevated, then all these dualities of so-called good and bad in the material world, it's not that they're not good and bad, but actually good means to become Krishna conscious, and bad means to become something other than Krishna conscious. So we've concocted what is good and bad. As one devotee from South Africa was telling me, that in South Africa people have a very simple way of understanding what's good and bad. The tribal people there, their idea of good is that if I'm alive, I'm good. It's very simple. And if you're dead, you're bad. So if I kill my enemy, he becomes bad because I killed him. And because I killed him and I'm alive, I'm good. They don't need any psychiatrist or anything to determine, you know, they don't have any remorse for killing someone, because if they're dead, they're bad. They deserve to be killed because they're bad. But in the material world, a little bit more sophisticated, every country usually concocts this whole idea about what's good and bad. It's a complete mental concoction. For instance, in America, if you watch, probably everyone has seen the American Westerns, right? Everyone's, at least, usually in America, we were brought up on American Westerns. And the cowboys were always the good guys. And the Indians were always the bad guys, the savages. They were supposed to be, it was more or less the same idea as South America, South Africa. When the Indians are dead, they're dead and they're bad. And a good Indian, as they used to say, is a dead Indian. So this is the idea. Similarly, the British were bad, the Americans were good. And in Americans, if you watch any of these American movies, which is quite a number of them, the Americans always say, we're the good guys. We're after the bad guys. Doesn't matter what the Americans do, they're the good guys. They kill, they rape, they steal, they slaughter, they plunder. But it's all right because they're good. They purify everyone that they steal from and rape and slaughter. They become purified. And they get the opportunity maybe in their next lifetime to take birth in America, and they can be good too. So this is all a concoction. Even just like World War II, the Germans were bad, and all their allies, and the Allies were all good. Even the Allies came over, Germany dropped fire bombs on all the cities there, killed thousands and hundreds, tens and thousands of innocent civilians, but they were all bad because they were Germans. And we were doing it, slaughtering civilians. We're good because we're Americans. It's good to kill them. They should be happy we're killing them because the Americans are killing them, or the British are killing them. So as one American Lieutenant General said, if we would have lost the war, I would have been tried as a war criminal. So it's simply some concoction, what's good and bad. People think, good means I gratify my senses. Bad, I can't, someone's an obstacle to gratify my senses. Therefore, it's all bad. Actual good is to get free from the bodily concept of life and come to the platform of becoming conscious of Krishna. That's good. And anything that helps us come to that platform is also considered good. And everything else that leads us away from Krishna and to that higher state of liberation from this bodily concept of life, that must be considered to be bad. Free from these dualities, this is good, this is bad, this is black or white or this and that, this is good for my sense gratification, this is bad for it. Real thing is free from these artificial dualities and seeing that people are not men and women, they're not black and white, they're not animals and human beings, they're souls within bodies that are in some species of life. To not just stop seeing the distinction between living entities, but ultimately to see the spiritual oneness that unites everyone together. Then one can engage in service to Krishna with full determination. That is, one can meditate and trance upon Krishna, which is the ultimate aim of all types of activities or all yoga systems. Prabhupada writes in the purport that those who are too sinful, those who are atheistic, those who are deceitful, those who are atheistic, deceitful, agnostic, and sinful, or foolish. Prabhupada writes foolish. Those who are sinful, deceitful, foolish, and atheistic, they can't take to the process of devotional service. So those who are discretinas, they never want to accept Krishna. Their whole idea is to decry Krishna, to fight against Krishna, to deny Krishna, to try to be happy without Krishna. So they never take to the process. And what is the process? In the beginning, simply to strain the senses by following some regulation. So the Vedas, even for those in the mode of ignorance, encourage them to, if you want to eat meat, then only eat goats once a month. Bring the goat to a mountainside where no one is. Whisper into the goat's ear, "My dear goat, now I'm going to cut your throat. But don't worry, because in your next lifetime, you'll become a human being, and I'll become a goat. And you can cut my throat." So in this way, by cutting enough goats' throats, you gradually get the message that you're going to become a goat for every time you cut someone's throat. And it's probably not worth the goat burger. So such people generally become vegetarians after some time. That's a step forward. By regulating one's sinful activities in the mode of ignorance, then one gradually rises to the platform of having enough brain power and enough patience, enough intelligence to hear what is the higher activities. Because we have to be engaged in activities. If we're not engaged in sinful activities, then naturally we'll inquire, what's the better activity? Then one will be engaged in pious activities, generally, under the Vedas, giving in charity, performing sacrifice. And by rising up to the platform of pious activities, one will be able to gain some knowledge about the real self. Gaining knowledge about our actual identity as a spiritual soul, one will take to the process of devotional service eventually, and then by taking to the process of devotional service, one will learn how to meditate and trance upon Krishna. So that's the process of elevation that Prabhupada writes, that all the great souls are traversing the earth, trying to teach people how to gradually be elevated to the platform of becoming conscious of Krishna. So what was able to be done in Satya Yuga by meditation directly upon Krishna, because there were no obstacles. There were no factories, there was no cinemas and so many different things going on. People, they knew how to think about Krishna directly, and they were in ecstasy doing it. They were full of transcendental pleasure, and they had no higher desire than that, because Krishna's pastimes are the pinnacle of all types of transcendental happiness. But when they became a little attached to sense gratification, a little idea of lauding it all in material nature, then sacrifice was introduced in Satya Yuga so that people could do some sacrifice, and by that sacrifice they come to the position where they could meditate upon and trance upon Krishna. But in Dwarpa Yuga, when people became further degraded and they not only couldn't meditate and trance upon Krishna, but they were reluctant even to perform sacrifice. They became more and more attached to their material possessions and thought more and more that this is I and this body and these things belong to me. Therefore, they were encouraged to go to the temple and worship the deities. After going to the temple and worshiping the deities, then they become a little purified and become enthusiastic to perform sacrifice for the deity. Then they could meditate and trance upon the deity. And in Kali Yuga, people don't want to go to the temple. They don't believe in God. They don't want to perform any sacrifice except for filling their empty belly. That's their sacrifice. And they don't want to, they don't know how to meditate on anything, what to speak on the Supreme Person. Their consciousness is so flickering that the commercials only last 5 seconds because people can't concentrate more than 5 seconds on anything. Therefore, in this age, the chanting of the holy name is there because Krishna is directly appearing as the holy name. And even if one is not very expert, but if one learns from the right source and tries in the right way to chant, then gradually one will be able to get more and more of Krishna's association, which will directly purify one, inspire one to worship either the deity within the mind, as Krishna manifests himself in his name, form, quality, and pastimes, and also go to the temple and worship the deity there. And then one will become encouraged to sacrifice one's possessions in the service of Krishna, and eventually one will become capable of meditating upon trance 24 hours a day upon Krishna while one is performing one's service to Krishna. So Lord Balaram sets the example that everyone is supposed to perform sacrifice. It is not that sacrifice is just meant for Treta Yuga. In this age, everything is mine. This age, we just chant Hare Krishna, take prasadam, and that's good. That's all we have to do. And we offer Krishna a little bit, and the rest is mine. Now, ultimately, we have to learn that everything belongs to Krishna. Everything is meant for sacrifice. And ultimately, the sacrifice in this age is the sankirtan, the sacrifice of the sankirtan jaga. So those who actually have enough intelligence, then they utilize everything they have in the sacrifice of the sankirtan jaga. That way they become purified and they're able to meditate upon Krishna 24 hours a day in trance and derive the highest state of realization and happiness by such a sacrifice. In the meantime, even if we don't understand this fully, we can keep on chanting Hare Krishna and gradually this will all be revealed to us. So, we'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
In the chapter, this battle between Bhima and Duryodhana, is that the battle that in the battle of Kurukshetra?
The end of the battle of Kurukshetra, yeah. Yes.
You do, even after chanting Mahamantra for a few years, but still in a devotee's mind, due to past conditioning, we do have some desires like that. So how can one find out these kind of desires?
You only have some desires. Well, you're very fortunate. You only have one or two. Don't worry then.
So how do we find out?
You want to find out your desires. Just sit down for a few minutes and chant a few rounds. And just write down whatever comes to your mind. You'll find out that it's very easily revealed what our desires are. Usually we want everything we don't have, and we lament the fact that we're not able to get it. That's our desire. We want to become God, and we're always lamenting the fact that we can't do it. That's basically it. We want to become the lords and enjoyers of the material creation, and we're always lamenting the fact that every attempt we had to do it ultimately wound up as a failure. We never exactly got exactly what we wanted. We always wanted more. And even if we got something we wanted, we eventually lost it anyhow. We were fearful of losing it. Yes?
How to inspire young ones to do chanting? Because they ask, why should I do chanting? What is the mechanism? How to verify your consciousness? How to tell them?
Well, we should chant ourselves and then we'll be able to explain to them. We chant ourselves and we're blissful. Then when we tell them, we'll be blissful. And they'll think, well, he's blissful. I might as well try it out myself. We say, oh, chant, you know, you got to chant these rounds every day. It's so blissful. They think, wow, I don't want to be like him. Yeah, I got to chant these rounds. Oh, God, I got 16 rounds left. I can't believe it. Chant, you'll be blissful like me.
They don't get it.
What's that?
Why should I chant?
Yeah, you shouldn't chant. You should keep on being blissful watching television. What do you tell them? They think they're blissful watching television. No, they think they're blissful watching television. Why talk to them?
But they really want to know what is the mechanism, how it cleanses the consciousness.
Because Krishna himself is the source of all bliss. Just like, how does the sun cleanse away the clouds in the sky? It burns them away. The sun is so powerful. So God is so powerful, it cleanses away all our contamination. God could do anything. So if we ask Him to please reveal yourself, as soon as Krishna reveals Himself, then automatically all the contamination goes away. That's God's power. Just like the sun is so powerful, it can purify even an impure place and not become infected by it. And if you don't believe me, then try it out. See for yourself. Yes?
Sometimes when you preach, then after a while, people might get a message and then they ask, do you think that everything you say in Krishna consciousness is bad? Or do you think that people who are not devotees are not good? And
well, what is their definition of good and bad? They don't even, for them it's just words, good and bad. You say, I'm good. People walk around saying, I'm good. Good for what? What are these people good for? they have to ask them, what are they talking about? Because it means completely different things to different people.
Well, usually they say, like, that as long as I don't hurt anybody, so badly.
What about all the ants you're stepping on? Yeah. What about all the microbes you're breathing in and just killing?
Well, that probably includes that it's not that bad.
Like, not that, I'm not that bad.
Bad enough to...
Yeah, so good and bad in the material world are all relevant. So you're not, we don't think that everyone is completely bad, they're just bad, that's all. Relatively speaking, someone else may be worse, but ultimately we're all bad in the Joe world, because if you go into a prison and you go do a survey amongst the prisoners and ask them how good they are, all the prisoners think they're good. They're good prisoners. So everyone here, you can say, yeah, we're all good prisoners. Some prisoners are worse and some prisoners are better. But just the fact that we're prisoners means that we must have done something wrong. So whatever we did wrong was bad. You yourself, by nature, you're good. But because you did something wrong, therefore you're in a bad position. So we want to put you in a good position, that's all. We don't want to criticize you.
How can you make people understand that there's actually a standard for being good and for being bad? Because most people, they come and say, they make their own standards, they have
to. Well, tell them that there's a God and He owns everything, and as soon as we try and steal from Him, we become bad. As soon as we utilize things as He would like us to, then we become good. We stop being a thief.
And then I said, that's a dogma.
Well, you think the sun rising at its appointed time every day is a dogma? The time is changing everything in the material world. Automatically we can see there must be a God. Otherwise, how you stop time? Time is above everything here. So time is a manifestation of God. It's changing everything. There's something above everyone here. So we can call that God. So how can you say it's a dogma? Everyone's perceiving it every moment. It's not a dogma. That our bodies are changing, but we're not changing. So we're entrapped by the illusory energy into identifying ourselves with something we're not. That's not dogma, that's reality. Yes?
Maharaj, we still have the simple desires for practicing variety. How do we avoid the tendency to dovetail things in Krishna's service?
Well, we want to dovetail things in Krishna's service.
In the name of dovetailing something.
You falsely do. Well, we have to chant Hare Krishna. We have to read the books. And we can learn from experience. Even if we can't learn by hearing, then we'll see that there's really... Eventually, if we become happy chanting Hare Krishna, we actually become conscious of Krishna, then these other things don't seem very important. We'll see, we're just wasting our time doing them. But in the absence of that, then we think that they'll give us some happiness or satisfaction. Therefore we pursue them till we find out what real happiness is. Yes, one.
Sometimes we are
assuming things, and we might be.
Sometimes we're assuming things. Sometimes.
And we might be like praying for speculating.
Praying for what?
Speculating.
Sometimes you speculate. Well, you're fortunate. Well, I prefer just to speculate than gamble. At least you don't lose very much. You just lose your time. Yeah, speculation. Maybe, I mean, our whole life here is a gamble. And the result of the gamble is just like if you gamble and you win, then they give you some prize. And if you gamble and you lose, then you lose everything. So our speculation means that we're going to win a body, another body. We may get the, you know, so-called prize of Brahma or whatever, or we may lose and get the body of a dog or a hog or a worm. So it's quite a gamble. Either way we lose, even if we get the body of Brahma, it's not such a big loss in one sense. But it's not the best thing to do. Better to give up this tendency to speculate, find out who we really are, and not having to take another body again. Because we think, if I get the body of Brahma, then there won't be actually any worries. Then I'll be on top, and everyone else will be on the bottom. And I'll actually have some happiness, some peace, from being the supreme controller in the universe. So that's a speculation too, because Brahma, according to Krishna, is also an anxiety about the future. He also is fearful of dying. Therefore, even the body of Brahma will not make us happy. So to think that there's some position in the material world that will make me happy, or there's something that I have to avoid here that will make me unhappy, that type of speculation is not very productive. Instead, we should not waste our time like that. We should try to focus, when we see we're speculating at least, because we're always speculating usually, but when we recognize that we're speculating, then better to fix our mind upon Krishna and do something productive. Then we'll get a spiritual body. And that will be the ultimate reward. One time Giriraj Maharaj was walking on the beach with Srila Prabhupada, and Giriraj Prabhupada gave some philosophical explanation or something. Giriraj Maharaj said, "Thank you very much, Prabhupada. I was in Maya before you said that." And Prabhupada started to chuckle and said, "You were in Maya?" He said, "You're always in Maya." Sometimes when we hear something, we get a little enlightened. At least, I mean, usually we recognize we're in Maya after hearing what's actually real. We see I'm misidentifying myself with this body. I actually believe I'm the doer of my activities. I doubt whether there's a God. I'm actually thinking that my, you know, so many different things. This is all due to Maya. But we shouldn't become depressed or embarrassed. We should become embarrassed, but not depressed that we're in Maya. Instead, we should do what's necessary to get out of Maya. But we shouldn't become, "I'm a devotee. Maya's far away. She never comes even near me anymore. As soon as she sees my tilak, my dhoti, immediately she turns away and flees. And once in a while, she comes close, I show her my japa beads." And she says, "Oh no, not japa beads." The invincible japa beads. No, we actually have to chant Hare Krishna purely, and then we'll understand even what Krishna's mind is. Even a great sage like Markandeya Rishi, when he got direct darshan of Vishnu, he was thinking, when Vishnu was leaving, "What is Maya?" And then Krishna had revealed to him what Maya is. He created a devastation that flooded Markandeya's Rishi's ashram for thousands and millions of years. He wound up in the devastation with timangal fishes trying to eat him, sharks trying to eat him, being freezing cold and suffering for millions of years in the ocean of devastation. And then he saw Krishna on a banyan leaf, sucking his toe. Krishna breathed him into his body. and then he's back in his ashram again. Then Krishna breathes out, he's back in the ocean of devastation. And he thought, now I know what Maya is. And he didn't want Maya anymore. He didn't want to figure out what Maya is. So we're not even clear how Maya is working in the material world. Under the spell of Maya, we're not even so clear actually what's going on here. So we should always be a little humble, realizing that we're in a hopeless, helpless position. Only Krishna can ultimately help us, and Krishna's representatives. And as soon as we think, wow, I've learned so much, I don't even need Krishna or his representatives anymore, well, that means we're back in Maya again. Okay, thank you very much. Grandhara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande. Yeah.